Daniel chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, on page 892. Hold on a sec. That's better. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the other, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth, but the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
It would be a very big help to me if you could keep that passage open as we look at it together. Let me pray for us as we start. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for the strange bits that we struggle to understand sometimes in the Old Testament. As much as the bits we're more familiar with. And we pray as we look at this passage tonight that you would help us to see you in it and to know about the Son of Man from it. Amen. I'm just going to grab my...
Am I still on?
So we're going to start this evening with a time of confession. I want you to think very carefully about the following question and answer it honestly by raising your hand for yes, if it applies to you. Here's the question. Have you ever been partway through a book, a novel, and flipped to the last page to see how it ends? Oh my word. Actually, I have done it a few times. I'm sorry to say. As shameful as that behaviour is, and it is shameful, it is actually a natural instinct, isn't it? When things are uncertain or scary, and we're struggling with them, even if it's just fiction, the thing that makes it bearable is knowing the ending, even if it's just seeing that the main character is still speaking on the last page. It's true in life, it's true in fiction, and it is also true in theology. Here's a more serious example. Horatio Spafford was an American lawyer and a Christian who lost nearly everything in the Great Fire of Chicago. And so in 1873, he decided to move with his family to Europe and start a new life there. His wife and his children came first by ship, and halfway across the Atlantic, their boat hit another boat and sank in just 12 minutes, killing all 226, not all, killing 226 people on board, including all four of his daughters, but not his wife. She survived and sent him a telegram from Europe, which began, "Saved alone." Saved alone. And as he then travelled to meet her, his boat took the same route. It crossed the Atlantic the same way. And as he passed the place of the disaster, he wrote there a hymn which we still sing today. I wonder if you know it. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." In the midst of extraordinary grief, and it's unimaginable, I have two daughters and I just can't imagine it. Here is a man who trusted God for himself and his family because he knew the ending. "But Lord," he wrote, "'tis for thee, for thy coming we wait. The sky, not the grave, is our goal." He knew the ending. Our topic tonight is Jesus' claim to be the Son of Man. It's a phrase which comes from Daniel chapter 7, which David just read to us. And so we're going to start with that. We're going to start by looking at Daniel 7. And then we're going to get to grips with that in context. And then we're going to move on to looking at the Gospels later on. And the headline of Daniel chapter 7, the thing that it's all about, is knowing the ending in the Christian life. Daniel was an Israelite living in captivity in Babylon. The Babylonian kings, so we meet three in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, who was mentioned in this passage, and Darius, often thought they were bigger than God. That was what they tended to think. And Daniel's overall message is that God is still God, even in this strange land. Some of Daniel is really familiar stories, so Daniel and the lion's den, those kinds of passages that we know well. But much of it is full of strange dreams and visions, like the one that we've just heard read in chapter 7. So we're going to be diving into that tonight. We're going to divide it into three chunks. I'm going to call them present reality, hidden reality, and future reality. Present, hidden, and future reality. So let's start with the first, which is present reality in verses 1 to 8. And I'm going to characterize that as horrible evil. Horrible evil. Daniel dreams that the wind is churning up a storm in the ocean, and out of the waves come these four, nightmare monsters. The first is like a lion with wings. The second is like a bear with half-eaten ribs in its mouth. The third is a leopard, except with four wings and four heads. And the fourth is like, well, it's like nothing Daniel's ever seen before. It's not like anything. All he can say is it's different and terrifying. It's got iron teeth to crush to bits and devour its victims. And then it tramples whatever's left over. It has 10 horns, and as Daniel watches, another horn kind of strangely sprouts with a horrible human face on it, human eyes and a mouth that's shouting out boasts about itself. Perhaps you've had the experience of waking up screaming from a nightmare and gradually realizing over time that it wasn't real and that everything's okay. That happened to me a few times as a kid. I remember one particularly bad dream where my parents had to keep reminding me before bed every evening for weeks afterwards that our house did not, in fact, have a dragon with orange teeth or a witch with blue jeans or an elf with a credit card, I don't know, in it. All of those things were just in my imagination. But Daniel, when he wakes up, will not have that comfort. Because in verse 17, we heard God explain the dream. Daniel 7:17, the four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth. In other words, this terrifying dream is a God-given picture of waking reality. It is about human history and human government. Now, there are lots of good reasons for linking particular beasts in this dream with particular human empires, specific empires. And Daniel and his hearers would have recognized those. But I don't want to get too distracted by that, really. Because I think the main point is actually to give us an impression of what human history will always be like. All human rule, now and then, is like this. It has the capacity for brutal evil, even if it's not always realized. And Daniel is to expect that, and those who follow to expect that. I think on this particular Sunday in the year, Remembrance Sunday, nobody's going to need convincing of that, are they? It was just as true in the 6th century BC as it is now in the 20th century AD, or the 21st century. When I was preparing, I'd intended just to kind of pick an example and talk about that a little bit. But actually, a little bit of time on Wikipedia lists just too many and too nauseatingly horrible things to talk about. 500,000 Armenians, 1 million Rwandans, 2 million Cambodians, 6 million Jews, systematically and brutally exterminated in living memory. Add them together and that's the entire population of Greater London. Imagine travelling on the train from here to the north of London and not seeing a person. Pol Pot, Joseph Stalin, Idi Amin. He had hundreds of thousands of Ugandans killed, some with sledgehammers. The nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bombs raised the surface temperature in those populated cities to about 6,000 Celsius. No. We don't need to imagine that the evil rulers of Daniel 7 are long past. And although Daniel is writing about empires, the same ruthless exercise of power is actually a present reality on a smaller scale too, isn't it? Every abusive parent or spouse or employer has the same mindset as the beastly kings of Daniel 7. In fact, the brutal beasts and the boastful horn are pretty accurate pictures, in some ways, of the sinful human heart, aren't they? Well, that's a pretty bleak picture, isn't it? Does Daniel have any hope at all for God's people in captivity? Is that present reality all that we have to expect? Should we not just give up? Well, in verse 9, the camera moves really abruptly. I'm going to call the second section, verses 9 and 10, the hidden reality of God's throne. So we've had the present reality of horrible evil. This is the hidden reality of God's throne. Daniel looks again. It's a very abrupt cut. And in verse 9, thrones are set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. After the dismal picture of verses 1 to 8, Daniel's dream zooms out and shows us the power structure of the universe. God on his throne, behind and above all human kingdoms. To get some idea of the scale of this, perhaps you could imagine that you have a little rubber rowing dinghy, and you've taken it out from Brighton Beach, and you're puttering around in the sea and having a good time in the sun. And then a couple of tourists come along in a motor yacht and start zooming around next to you. Look at that pathetic little boat, they shout, pointing at you. And they zoom back and forth and rock your little tiny boat with their waves. And of course, you can't get away because you can't row as fast as they can travel. And then you look up, and over the horizon comes the USS Nimitz. It's the largest aircraft carrier in the States. It's a third of a kilometer long. It weighs 100,000 tons. It has a crew of 5,000, 90 aircraft, 4 missile launchers, and 2 Westinghouse nuclear reactors to power it. Suddenly, your view of who is in charge off Brighton Beach will change radically, won't it? It will change hugely. Well, the picture in Daniel has the same kind of impact for the hearers of its day as that image has for us. The dream had something like that effect. Let's hit a few of the high points of verses 9 to 10. I'm going to put them up there on the screen. There are 3. First of all, God has always been in charge. He's always been in charge. He's the Ancient of Days. And by the way, in Hebrew culture, that doesn't imply kind of doddery and frail. So if you feel like you're Ancient of Days, perhaps that's an encouragement to you tonight. He's dignified and grand. That's how it would have been read. The Ancient of Days. And of course, if he's Ancient of Days, he has always been there. Did you notice in verses 1 to 8 that the authority of the beasts is always on loan? Did you notice that? The lion had its wings torn off from outside and it's given a human heart. The bear was told to stand and eat human flesh. The leopard is given authority to rule. And the fourth beast has 3 horns that are uprooted from outside. Their authority is on loan. Behind them, the Ancient of Days has always been in charge. And so he doesn't need to rush into battle with these beasts. He simply sits calmly down on his throne in verse 9. So he's always been in charge. And secondly, his power and fury are unmatched. Look at verse 10 with me. Serving him are thousands upon thousands, 10,000 times 10,000. This is Daniel kind of struggling with his multiplication table. God's army can't be counted. There's more there than he can enumerate. God's throne is flaming with fire. It is carried on blazing wheels in verse 9. And there's a river of fire coming out from before him, verse 10. In the Old Testament, when evil meets God's presence, we quite often see that it's burned up with flame. That's a common picture of God's incandescent fury at sin and evil. His power and fury are unmatched. And third, his purpose is justice. In verse 10 at the end, it says, "The court was seated and the books were opened." This isn't a rebellion against beastly kingdoms. It is the court in which those kingdoms will be held to account. It is the court that has the power to deal with them and destroy them. But Daniel's dream does not stop there. After showing Israel who is really in charge, the dream goes on to show what happens next, or rather what God is going to do next. So let's look at our last chunk of Daniel. We've seen the present and the hidden reality. I'm going to call this one future reality of a new king. A new king in verses 11 to 14. The court of the Ancient of Days basically does 2 things. The first thing it does is deal with the beasts. And it's almost a throwaway sentence between verses 11 and 12. And it's sandwiched in there between these 2 glorious visions of the throne room. Daniel says in halfway through verse 11, "I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire." After all those dramatic descriptions, it's just dispensed within a line. And then something else happens. "I looked," says Daniel, "and before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." God installs a new king. And he's different from the beastly kings in every imaginable way, in every possible way. Again, let's hit some of the high points of those differences. I've got five. First of all, he's human. He's like a son of man in verse 13. That phrase, son of man, is actually ordinary Hebrew for a human being. It's not necessarily a title. It's just ordinary Hebrew for a human being, a human man. It occurs in the Old Testament all over the place, referring to humans. So Ezekiel, you get it more than 90 times where God's addressing Ezekiel as a son of man. And actually even Daniel is addressed as a son of man a chapter later. So it's a normal phrase referring to a human. And it is very striking that the human kingdoms of verses 1 to 8 are shown as nightmare beasts, but God's ruler is shown as fully, perfectly human. His rule will not be beastly. It won't be bestial. It will be perfectly humane. So he's perfectly human. Secondly, he's fully divine. I wonder if you noticed that the beasts came from the winds churning the sea in verse 1. Among other things, that image is an echo of Genesis 1, verse 2, the spirit, the breath of God moving over the waters. It's a way of saying that the beasts come from within the created world. They come from within the fallen created order. But God's new king comes with the clouds of heaven. Again, it's common Old Testament language to show God coming to be with his people. So do you remember Moses going up Mount Sinai to receive the law, and the God coming down in this great cloud to meet him there? And it's common throughout the Old Testament, that picture. He's not just perfectly human, the new king. He is also fully God. Thirdly, his authority is completely different. Nice way to see this is just to look at the difference in language between verse 5 and verse 14. Here's verse 5, the bear is pulled off the floor and told to stand and eat flesh. Verse 14, the new king walks into God's throne room and is given authority and glory and sovereign power. You see, the bear is this kind of disgusting parody of tyranny, isn't it? And the new king is a mirror of God's own authority, somebody who can stand before the Ancient of Days. So his authority is different. Fourthly, his rule is completely secure. I don't need to say much about that. In verse 14, it says his dominion will not pass away and will never be destroyed. It won't end. And fifth, his rule will end the exile of God's people. Verse 14 tells us that all peoples and nations will worship him. In other words, you won't have any Nebuchadnezzars saying, bow down to my golden statue anymore. You won't have any Dariuses saying, you may only pray to me anymore. Both of those happen in the early chapters of Daniel. And in verse 17, God explains, just to make sure we get it, that God's people will possess the kingdom forever when he's explaining the dream. Perfectly human, fully divine, sovereign godlike authority, everlasting security for God's people. Do you see how knowing the ending makes a difference to those captives in Babylon? They're under attack, and Daniel 7 agrees that that attack is the present reality for them. But it says, don't fix your eyes on that. Fix your eyes somewhere else, on the hidden reality of God's throne room, where the real power in the universe has always lain, and on the future reality of God's new king, who's going to come and restore everything that is broken. They are living in the dark, but they are to look at the light. They've seen the end, and they know that it's worth waiting for. So what I want to do now is turn to the New Testament, to the Gospels, and see, in fact, in Mark's Gospel, to see how Jesus claims that title as the new king from Daniel 7:13. Just to stick with the theme, let's title this bit Gospel Reality, the Son of Man, Gospel Reality. Now, that phrase, the Son of Man, appears in 78 verses of the Gospels. It's clearly the title that Jesus chooses for himself, because of those 78 verses, 76 of them are Jesus' own words being reported by the writers, and the other two are other people quoting Jesus and being reported by the writers. So it is very clearly the title that Jesus chooses to refer to himself. Our first question has to be, does he mean it in the just a human being sense, just the general sense? Or does he want us to refer to Daniel 7, verse 13, and see him as that Son of Man? I think there's an easy answer to that. Let's look at Mark 14 for just one example. Mark chapter 14, verses 61 and 62, if you want to turn to it. I can tell you what page. It is on 1022, thank you. So Jesus is before the exasperated high priest. He's on trial before the Jewish council. And the exasperated high priest says to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Don't let anybody say to you that Jesus never claimed to be divine. It's just not true. He boldly tells the high priest that he is the Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Man, who will sit by the throne of the Ancient of Days and come on the clouds of heaven. It's a clear reference to Daniel 7, isn't it? It's got all the same language, all the same hallmarks. And for sure the high priest got it, because the next thing he does is rips his robes and screams about blasphemy. Now, if you went through all of those gospel references, about half of those 78 references have that sense of Jesus talking about his authority and his future return. Quite often they use that language of Daniel 7, the clouds of heaven, coming on the clouds of heaven. So that's half of them. What about the other half? Well, it turns out they're massively surprising. If you turn back a few pages, if you've gone to Mark, we'll just look at one example where Peter has finally identified Jesus in Mark chapter 8. It's page 1012, if you're in the New Testament. Peter's finally identified Jesus as the Christ, which is the same person in Old Testament language as the Son of Man. And here is what happens next. This is Mark 8, verse 31. He, that's Jesus, began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. The Son of Man must die. About 25 times in the Gospels, Jesus says things that are very like this. The Son of Man must be rejected and suffer and die and rise again. The disciples knew Daniel 7, and they're horrified. Peter kind of grabs him by the elbow and takes him aside and rebukes him. "How can you say this, Jesus?" And Jesus responds, this is verse 33, "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." In other words, the Son of Man must die, and to suggest otherwise is to let the beasts of Daniel 7 win. Because if Jesus does not go to the cross, the fury of the Ancient of Days will fall upon God's people as well. Every human carries the same arrogant, sinful heart as those beastly kings. It's less visible a lot of the time, but it is no less black. And if the Son of Man does not go to the cross to bear there the full force of God's fury at sin, then neither will he be able to carry them to glory. Perhaps you know the story of the lion, the witch and the wardrobe, where Aslan the lion chooses to die in place of Edmund the traitor. And there's a moment at the end where that seems like a catch-22. If Aslan hadn't died for Edmund, then Edmund would have been killed by the witch. But now that Aslan is dead, there's nothing to stop the witch killing him anyway, overrunning Narnians and defeating them all. And there's this battle between the witch's army on one side of ogres and werewolves and ifrits and sprites and orkneys and woozies and ettins. I love the names. They're all on one side, and the Narnians are on the other side, led by Edmund and Peter. And the Narnians are losing. They're getting whooped. And then Aslan comes back to life. And Lewis writes, "With a roar that shook all Narnia from the western lamppost to the shores of the eastern sea, the great beast flung himself upon the White Witch." You see, the battle is finally won for Edmund by both Aslan's death on his behalf and Aslan's rising to life to defeat evil. They're both needed, otherwise he dies. Jesus wanted his followers to know the ending before it happened, to know that his death is not the end of hope. In fact, it's the source of hope, isn't it? And to know that neither sin or evil will win in the end, because the Lamb will win. And he wants us to keep our eyes fixed on that future. Let's, as we finish off, think about three short applications of those passages. First, can I say, let's make sure we understand who Jesus is, who Jesus says he is. The devil loves nothing better than to convince us that Jesus is a helpful moral teacher. And if you're trying to decide what to make of Jesus tonight, please don't fall into that trap. Jesus of Nazareth deliberately identifies himself as the divine rescuer of God's people, the Son of Man, who is the Son of God, who will defeat evil and be king forever. Don't make a mistake about it. It is a massive, earth-shattering claim. If he's wrong, then he's a lunatic. But that is the only Jesus who is on offer. He won't let us treat him as a hobby or a moral compass or a comforting philosophy. So let's make sure we understand who Jesus says that he is. Second, as we go out to face the world this week, let's remember what victory looks like from God's throne room. The power base of the beasts and of the empires they represent, whether that's kind of government-sized empires or family-sized empires, is arrogance and brutality and animal cruelty. But the authority of the Son of Man is about gentle humanity and self-sacrifice, giving himself up for his people. If we're going to learn to live in the kingdom of the Son of Man, we need to exercise our authority his way. I don't know what contexts you're going to have authority in this week. Maybe there aren't many, maybe there are lots. If you're a boss, or a father, or a mother, or a husband, or a big brother, or a big sister, football coach, a group leader, whatever it is, don't exercise your authority like the nightmare beasts. Exercise it like the Son of Man. But third, and I think most importantly from these passages, hear the comfort of knowing the ending before we get there. Daniel 7 was written to God's people in their darkest possible times. And it's written to move their eyes from their suffering to God's throne room and God's future king. It won't stop their pain, but it will keep them from panic. And Jesus Christ, the Son of Man, offers us the same comfort. We know the end of the story. When we're persecuted and trodden down, when power over us seems like a total abuse, we're struggling with our sin, our own sin, or our own little boastful voices. When suffering and sorrow in this broken world seem so big that they threaten to overwhelm us, you and I know the ending. We know the ending. In early or olden days, catechisms were often used as this sort of question and answer tool to help people learn doctrine. We don't use them much now, but some of them are terrific. And question 52 of the 16th century Heidelberg Catechism puts this particular truth incredibly well. The question is this: what comfort is it to you that Christ shall return to judge the living and the dead? And here's the answer: that in all my sorrows, with uplifted head, I look for the very same one who beforehand offered himself to the judgment of God for me. I look for him who died as the curse for me. I look for him to return as judge who shall cast all his and my enemies into everlasting condemnation, but take me with all his chosen ones into everlasting joys and glory. There's a great quote from an 18th century housekeeper called Ruth Clark, who, as she lay old and dying, was asked if she had any doubts about what would come next. And she replied, "He who has loved me all my life through will not forsake me now." Amen.